That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast...
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
One small step backwards for mankind. NASA is forced to abort its mission to return to the moon.
To people who are working on these programs, this is like a death in the family.
President Obama says he just can't afford the Constellation program.
We simply cannot continue to spend as if deficits don't have consequences, as if the hard-earned tax dollars of the American people can be treated like monopoly money.
Going back to the moon in general is a very cool idea, but right now there's just a lot more important things that we should be spending that money on.
It's really important to hear about like what's going on up there, if there's water, if there's not water. So I think it's completely ridiculous if he would stop that.
It's been called one of the media's greatest ever science problems. And now, after 10 years, the final lingering link between the MMR jab and autism is severed.
The allegations against me and against my colleagues are both unfounded and unjust. I repeat, unfounded and unjust.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. In the studio today are the Observer Science Editor, Robin McKee, and The Guardian's In Sample. Hello, gentlemen.
Hi there.
Hello there.
And also here is the pod's favourite person, Kevin Fong. Hello and welcome.
Hello.
It says here you're the Director of the Centre for Aviation, Space and Extreme Environment Medicine at the University College London. Is that still true?
No, that's not still true.
No. this is why you're going to correct me.
I'm a lecturer in space medicine at University College
space
these days.
Space medicine. How exciting. You can guess why we've dragged him here. It's to discuss the significance of last week's NASA developments. Back in the 1960s, President Kennedy started the race for the moon.
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one we intend to win.
Then it was President Bush who got behind the idea of going back.
We will build new ships to carry man forward into the universe, to gain a new foothold on the moon, and to prepare for new journeys to the worlds beyond our own.
And who would have thought it would be President Obama who put the nail in the coffin?
I've proposed a freeze in government spending for 3 years. This won't apply to the benefits folks get through Social Security, Medicaid, or Medicare. And it won't apply to our national security, including benefits for veterans. But it will apply to all other discretionary government programs. We've gone through every department spending, line by line, item by item, looking for inefficiency, duplication, and programs that have outlived their usefulness.
The president's budget proposal didn't have the funds to sustain NASA's $81 billion Constellation program. This is the reaction of NASA Administrator Charles Bolden, who likened the cuts to the lunar budget to a death in the family.
You know, when you have a program that's just going to cost a fortune to resurrect, and schedules are getting harder to make without much more money, then wisdom says you pick a new course. And so that's what we've done.
So to discuss all of this, of course, is Kevin Fong. Kev, this has been on the cards for a long time. We've had review after review in the Obama administration. He's been here for a year. No one knew what was going to happen to Constellation. Is this really a surprise?
It would have been easier, I think, for him to let it go on like some zombie program and do it later. I think this is a bold move from Obama and Bolden. So in that respect, I think it was a surprise. Is it the wrong thing or the right thing to do? I'm not sure. I'm quite impressed with it, actually.
So this is the idea that we're not going to go back to the moon in 2020, something that they've been saying for a long time. Last year's celebrations for the Apollo moon landings, the NASA were again talking about how they were going to go back to the moon, go to Mars. Is it a disappointment?
Appointment. Well, it remains to be seen what happens with this. I mean, there were many question marks over the Constellation program. There were many insiders who were sort of intimating that they weren't sure it was the right direction. Moon Mars has been an obsession of the former administrator Griffin's for decades, long before he was NASA administrator. So he's obviously torn up to see it go. But this represents, you know, the need to move on to something more sustainable, I think, in space. You know, we see this in economic cycles. We see programs come and go in NASA. There have been a number of vehicles out there that have been, you know, going to be the next best thing in human spaceflight and then have disappeared. X-33, X-38, all of those. And now we're seeing, in the austere economic times, the need to move on to something that's going to survive hardships.
So what does that look like? I mean, this Obama announced that the Constellation is gone, but does that mean that we carry on using the space shuttle? I mean, they carry on using the space shuttle? Because that's meant to retire imminently. And they were going to buy tickets on the Soyuz to get up to the space station. What happens to the space station? How does that get serviced? I mean, how do all these questions start getting answered?
Well, as far as I understand, they've plans now to fly space station out to 2020. There are a lot of people who'd like to see shuttle fly out to 2015. It's probably not going to do that. It's probably going to retire in the next year or so. I think that they're going to rely heavily on the Russians for their human spaceflight capability. I think we're going to see the longest gap in the history of human spaceflight with the United States without independent access, human access to space.
Robin, what happens to sort of the international scene? I mean, if the Americans are not going back to the moon, who else is on the cards?
Well, China is obviously in the front running there, and they seem to have a fairly robust lunar program. And certainly from their perspective, there's something to gain from that, because the point of America going to the moon was not really for scientific reasons. It was to show the world what they could do technologically. They've shown they've done it. So the Chinese go to the moon, and then it shows that they've arrived as an international space power and a dynamic technological nation.
I mean, Ian, is the first person on the moon in this century going to be Chinese? Then
I think almost undoubtedly. Just a couple of things on this. I mean, very recently, as in a few weeks ago, NASA put out a notice to museums that the shuttles that they were going to be giving out to places like the Smithsonian on the Mall in DC would be available 6 months earlier than they had previously said. So they'll now be available from July next year. So the shuttle program is going to be grounded unless, that isn't a binding statement, but it looks like they're planning for the shuttles not to be flying anywhere. NASA is going to be relying on Soyuz to be getting into space. Now, what was interesting from some of the people I've spoken to about this is they wonder how tenable the Obama strategy is, essentially, because if you think we get private industry in to come and do the day-to-day stuff to the space station while we focus on going to Mars, if China does waltz in, and they're the only country who's likely to, let's face it, if they do waltz in and start doing stuff on the moon, especially if they start doing some interesting permanent stuff, it's not going to be like 1969 when there are shadowy images. It's going to be HDTV. It's going to be all singing, all dancing 21st century stuff that will be incredibly visual and will be very hard to stomach if you're American in Congress. I think it will be politically really difficult for Obama to keep the position he's keeping.
Is there any chance at all that NASA is going to do some bilateral agreements with like ESA or the Chinese?
Well, it's very clear that Obama wants to make human spaceflight, space exploration in general, a very international affair. The big issue here is whether the future of human space exploration and space exploration in general is where it's this expression of imperialism it's a torch that's passed from superpower to superpower to show, you know, this is what we do, or whether it matures into something more sustainable. I mean, I think Antarctic Survey is a very good analogy for this. You know, that was the sort of thing that you went there, you explored it, you didn't care if there was anything to discover, you just want to go there to show that you were pretty hard and well-resourced as a nation. And then later, in the 20th century, you turned up, you know, with exploration teams and mature programs of exploration, which were supported by commercial infrastructures. You know, you no longer made the boat that took you down south. You got on a plane, you paid your ticket, you embarked on a commercial boat to take you down to the south. And then right at the end, you deployed your exploration architecture. That's what I'd like to see. That's what I think Obama has in mind. I do not think that they can continue to do space for the next 50 years the way they've done it in the last 50 years.
So this is things like Space Adventures and Virgin Galactic and all of these sorts of organizations who are going to send space tourists up in the next couple of decades. I mean, is that the future for near Earth space exploration at least? Well, that's not much exploring space going on there.
Well, I think it's difficult. The whole commercial spaceflight thing is more nuanced than people have it. You know, I think people think, just give it, you know, the libertarians out there say, you know, just give it out of commerce and they'll do everything for you. I do not think that they will have programs of exploration. You know, it doesn't do away with the need for national programs of exploration. You know, after all, there's no British Airways Antarctic Exploration Survey. They get them half the way and then you need to have a national program that follows up after that. So I also hope that we are going to see some of the commercial teams make good on their promises. So Elon Musk, I'm hoping, he promises like two orders of magnitude reduction in launch fees. I hope he's right even by one order of magnitude. And then a lot of things become possible that have never been possible.
Robin, the idea of commercial spaceflight is quite exciting. I mean, you've seen some of these places, I believe.
I haven't been to them. I've talked to the guys. Yeah. I've talked to Virgin Galactic and those people.
How credible are they to you? I mean, they're going to get up to space, but they're not exactly going to get to the moon, are they?
Well, no. I mean, you think for about $250,000, you get 6 minutes weightlessness and a chance to vomit in a very, very small capsule, which I kind of don't think is money well spent.
Do that on a Saturday night.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You do that in 6 pints of Carlsberg and Soaky Hall Street, as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, why spend the money? I mean, I think the basic problem is that nobody's really found out a good purpose for going into outer space. And I think that everything that's happened in the last 20, 30 years has indicated that robot probes we'll do it much better. And all the exciting stuff that's come from space exploration has come from the Cassini-Huygens mission, the Hubble Space Telescope and these things. And so the whole basis of putting men in space, it doesn't have a purpose, and we have to address that purpose before we go any further.
Kevin, this has been your life's work for the last 15 or so years about putting men and women into space. What, give Robin your two barrels.
Both barrels. I think let's face it, I think astronauts continue to be exciting. I mean, I think we see that in the popular culture and the way that stories continue to be told about that. I think Apollo's anniversary last year continued to show that you know, people continue to be ignited by the whole idea. I think they do have a purpose in space, but you know, the simple debate of is it robots or humans, I think, has begun to go away. I think it's both, and there are some things that I think only humans can do in the exploration environment, and some things that only robots and automated platforms can do. I think for the exploration, the comprehensive exploration of the surface of the Moon and Mars, were that to occur, I think human teams in situ, I think, would be very, very useful. And I would have hoped that if we were progressive in our exploration ambitions, that we would be able to access the surface of the Moon by the middle of this century, the way we access Antarctica. That's not impossible. You know, you could see that happening, and there's no reason to suggest that the scientific yield from the surface of the Moon would be any less than that we've had from Antarctica in the last century.
We've skittered around the issue of the British involvement in any of this. And Britain did get its first astronaut last year after many, many years of campaigns. Ian...
it's first official astronaut.
Official astronaut, yes, sorry.
Helen Sharman has already, you know, is our first astronaut.
Yes, you're right, of course. First official government-funded astronaut, let's say.
Not by our government.
Sort of through our government.
Through our user subscription, okay.
But anyway... but Ian, so does that mean that what happens to the ESA sort of projects? I mean, well, they have some sort of vague plans to get back to the moon, but I mean, it's nothing even planned properly, is it?
No, I mean, one thing that was interesting was when the when ESA took on its last recruits for its astronaut corps, among whom was Tim Peake, who you're talking about, Major Tim, as we undoubtedly called him in the press. Because we're all so old, we remember David Bowie. ESA talked about, you know, among these people could be the first European to walk on the moon. That's still, you know, could be. But, you know, you'd think that ESA is not going to do it unilaterally. It does, you know, you'd imagine that would be piggybacking either on a NASA thing or perhaps in some kind of collaboration with the Russians. I mean, you know, ESA obviously the Russians have Soyuz and Europe European Space Agency has great links with them, so that they could do it that way. They could think about trying to man-rate the Ariane 5 and fly themselves from Kourou. I don't know how pie in the sky that is, Kevin. You probably have a far better grip of this than I do.
I mean, it's very difficult to take the architectures that you have and then just retrofit them. Yeah, it's more than sticking a Robin Reliant on the top of an Ariane and there you go, way hey, man-rated vehicle.
But they've looked at doing it.
There are an awful lot of missions that was it someone said to me? There are a lot of missions that continue to be and will always be PowerPoint missions, and I think these are amongst them. ESA, look at this whole in context and step back. Whatever NASA is doing, whichever direction it's going in, it still spends more on space than every single country in the world put together, you know, unless the Chinese are suddenly squirreling away $20 billion on it. So what NASA does really influences the rest of the world. The direction that NASA is now going to take is going to influence what Europe does. Europe will not decide to do its own thing. I can't see it.
All right. Well, for more on all of this, go to guardian.co.uk/science. Let's have a look now at some of the other science stories around this week.
News Jack.
Doctors have successfully communicated with a man in a vegetative state. The man, who's been laying in a hospital bed with severe brain injuries for 7 years, has had his thoughts read by a scanner. The 29-year-old was told to think tennis for yes and imagine looking round his home for no. The finding raises issues over treatment and care for those in similar situations.
A headline in New Scientist this week read, "Mass drug overdose, no one died." It's after homeopathy protesters demonstrated outside Boots pharmacies across the UK. Skeptics swallowed whole bottles of pills in an attempt to show that the remedies are ineffective and the treatments have no scientific basis. The event, called 1023, claimed the remedies are nothing but sugar pills.
Research by psychologists at Birmingham University shows that reactions are faster than conscious thought. In mock gunfights, volunteers were 10% faster when they drew second than when they made the first move. The difference was on average only 21 milliseconds, too slow to beat someone who had already pulled a gun. Dr. Andrew Welchman says, "You move faster if you draw second, but you're still going to die."
And start running and watch your brain grow. A study shows aerobic exercise triggers new cell growth in the region of the brain linked to recollection.
Let's have a look at some of those stories in a bit more detail. Ian, you're going to be our man on this. The first story we're going to look at is the communication with the guy in the vegetative state. This is, it's quite incredible research, this.
It is, yeah. And it uses, just to zip through what they've done, this uses a technique called functional magnetic resonance imaging, where you can see changes in brain activity in relation to time, so how things progress. And they essentially got this guy who was in a, I don't know if they still define it as persistent vegetative state, but he presumably was beforehand, managed to give him some sort of commands to think about two very different things that would give you different signatures in an fMRI scanner. So one of them was imagine walking around his flat going through from room to room, and the other was to imagine playing tennis. So if you think you're playing tennis, it can activate some sort of aspects of your brain to do with motor function. And the signatures look different. So you can use those two brain states to answer questions. So think about tennis to answer yes, or think about moving around your house to answer no. And so they asked him some very simple questions about his family and such like, which he answered correctly.
I mean, according to one of the researchers involved, one in five patients in a vegetative state may have a fully functioning mind. Whether you believe that stat or not, I can see you screwing up your face at that. But what do you make of research like this? How does it sort of affect how doctors should treat their patients in this situation?
Consciousness is one of those great, it's one of the last dark continents of science, I think. And this is not my area of expertise. Clinically, in the intensive care unit, we do deal with people who we think are unconscious, don't have the mental capacity to self-determine. And that is really the you know, what the interest I took out of this story. You know, we make assumptions about people's level of responsiveness when they're critically unwell, when they're in intensive care units, etc. And so the worrying thing here is, well, you know, maybe some of these people have a slightly higher level of awareness than we previously thought they did. I'm not familiar with the precise findings of this study, or indeed the detail of it. fMRI is an extremely new tool. I mean, it's little more than 10, 15 years since it sort of just first emerged on the scene. But yeah, it would be a total, you know, this has a massive implications for certainly the ethics of our practice in medicine.
Talking about other sort of unconscious things, one of the stories you wrote this week was all about who draws quicker in a gunfight. You know, you're standing at the OK Corral or similar, Han Solo, Greedo, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's two people that's going to fire at each other.
High Noon Paradox.
Exactly. So
as I like to call
it. Through it. And curiously, what does Niels Bohr have to do with this?
Well, Niels Bohr, obviously, you know, heavily involved with coming up with structure of the atom and, you know, quantum mechanics in 1920s and earlier. He was obsessed with cowboy movies, very, very into them. And he was intrigued by this idea, yes, aware it was a Hollywood script device, but intrigued nonetheless that the goodie always drew his gun second, but still always got the baddie, still always managed to pull the trigger first, even though he drew second, because that's what, you know, a goodie's never going to just kill someone in cold blood. So he had this theory that actually maybe there's something in this. Maybe, you know, if you react to something, you actually are faster than if you do an intentional action.
And this is what they found?
Yeah, so what he did is him and George Gamow, another Russian-born American physicist, they worked together. Gamow went out and bought some cap guns, and then they had a little light. They had they basically just got they'd ambushed Niels Bohr around the lab and, you know, pulled the gun, and Bohr was just fast. He would beat them. Now it's put
is
up there.
Is this really true?
It's absolutely true.
Niels Bohr's running around with a cap gun in his lab.
It's in George Gamow's autobiography.
We know what you scientists get up to. You know.
When you try and study this in the lab, what you find is that yes, people will react faster. A reactive movement will be faster than an intentional one. If I go to draw a gun and you're just stood there looking at me, I'll be slower than if you pull an eye, try and react to it. But I won't be so fast that I actually beat you. So I might have my gun out of my holster, but you'll still shoot me.
So how does that explain Han Solo? I mean, I suppose the thing is that Han Solo's...
He shot him under the table.
He shot him under the table. Yeah. Greedo was doing nothing aggressive. Oh, no, Greedo had a gun out on the
If you look at the sort of the remastered version, Greedo does fire first.
Really?
Misses him.
Yeah, that's an awful bit of remastering, by
terrible.
The way. It's just dreadful.
Can I say this conversation is getting very sad? I just thought I would interject that bit.
So basically, you're still going to die if you shoot first.
Let me go through. I mean, there's just the speed. Yeah. So the speed that people they mimicked what this movement would be. I mean, it wasn't a gunsling that they tried to mimic in the lab, but they had you pushing a series of buttons, a sequence, and it took people on average 200 milliseconds. Kind of did it. You do it in about 180 if you react, 200 if you go first. So it just means that reactions can be faster than intentional thought.
Okay. Well, we'll leave all that stuff there. If you want to know more, go to guardian.co.uk/science or environmentguardian.co.uk.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
The vaccine for measles, mumps and rubella, which is given to most children over the age of one, has been linked with autism.
For his supporters, Andrew Wakefield is a hero. And despite prompting a major health scare, he seemed unrepentant.
No regrets, thank
you. A possible link between MMR and autism was first reported 10 years ago. Immunisation rates in London have plummeted.
This is yet another example of inaccurate reporting of something that's really important, because we're seeing a significant drop in take-up
of MMR.
Recently
we saw a television news report about something that really stuck in my mind, which was the link between the MMR vaccine and autism. Why wouldn't it just be safer to separate the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine?
This is a very emotional issue, and it springs from a report that came out of the United Kingdom in 1998. And this was a report of 12 children that had neurodevelopmental delay, 8 of whom had autism.
Research has been stifled by not allowing doctors to continue with this research.
You know, we're fed up with hearing what doesn't cause autism. We want to know what does cause autism and what...
In 1997, the year before he went public, 91% of children were vaccinated with MMR. By 2003, that had plunged to less than 80%. As a result, cases of measles soared from 56 in 1998 to 736 in 2006.
12 years after its publication, The Lancet has retracted the paper that sparked a crisis for the measles, mumps and rubella, or MMR, vaccine. Many in the scientific and medical community had been pressing for the paper, published in February 1998, and which seemed to link the MMR jab to bowel disease and autism, to be quashed. The journal's decision follows the recent ruling by the General Medical Council that the paper's author, Andrew Wakefield, had been dishonest. This was Dr. Wakefield's reaction.
The allegations against me and against my colleagues are both unfounded and unjust. I repeat, unfounded and unjust. And I invite anyone to examine the contents of these proceedings and come to their own conclusions. On a personal note, I am dismayed that two of the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologists, Professor John Walker Smith and Professor Simon Mersch, have been dragged through this process. And it remains finally for me to thank the parents whose commitment and whose loyalty has been extraordinary. And I want to reassure them that the science will continue in earnest.
That was Dr. Andrew Wakefield reacting to the recent ruling by the General Medical Council against him. The Lancet Journal's editor, Richard Horton, told The Guardian that as soon as he'd read the GMC findings, he realised the paper had to be retracted. Okay, well, let's go through the background of this story, which has been rumbling on for, as we said, more than a decade now. Robin, what was initially up with the study? I mean, it was a series of case reports. It wasn't...
Yeah, the trouble up with the study, as was said at the time, was a remarkably small sample that was done on about 10 kids who were found to have virus in their guts. And Wakefield linked this. These children had autism and linked the fact they'd been had an MMR vaccines and sort of produced a line of logic that went from A to B to C with very, very, very little evidence.
And how did that then become the sort of media sensation that it has become for the last 12 years?
Well, I suppose it's got all the right ingredients. It's, you know, vulnerable children. Are parents actually harming their own children? There's an apparently eminent doctor saying that it was. You could understand in some ways the reaction of parents, despite the fact that, you know, most of the medical establishment, virtually all of it, said the MMR was safe.
It's almost like an ultra precautionary principle at that point. Kevin, the study itself, as Robin said, it was a very small sample size, and also the links between A, B, and C sort of weren't scientifically very rigorous. I mean, what was the issue that the scientists had with it?
Well, I think that you're right. I think this is a Swiss cheese model failure of the whole system.
You'll have to explain that metaphor.
Swiss cheese, you know, holes everywhere.
Oh, I see.
You guys, you've got to catch up. There's nothing wrong with taking a small sample and generating a hypothesis of that. That would have been not wrong. What was wrong was to then have a conclusion which had nothing to do with the scientific findings, to go to a press conference, as I understand it from the reports, and suggest everyone should take single vaccines without even declaring that you've got a patent filed on a single vaccine. And that was just the beginning. I mean, as this evolved for me, I went from thinking, this poor guy, he's been carried along on this tide of sort of a big story and he's a bit of a victim, to hearing the detail. I mean, if those reports are true of him, you know, giving kids £5 to take their blood at parties, unnecessarily doing lumbar punctures, so spinal taps on children. You know, these are, if those are true, that is unforgivable, and in large swathes of the community, he will remain unforgiven.
This is the interesting thing, isn't it? The GMC hearing, where it's likely he's going to be struck off the medical register, did reveal the fact that several months before the paper was filed in The Lancet, he had patented a single vaccine, and also that he'd received money from the legal aid to sort of fund some of his research, legal aid bills for that. And it just seems like a genuine conflict of interest when he published. Now, this doesn't, this is quite circumstantial. It doesn't necessarily mean that just because he has a single vaccine that promoting the single vaccine is necessarily a bad thing. But why has it taken so long to get through all of this? Well, why 12 years later have we does it look like we might finally draw a line under it?
I don't think we'll draw a line under it. I don't think we ever will, really. It will hopefully fade away. As to why it took 12 years to have this paper withdrawn, a very good question. I'd like to know that. I think it should have been withdrawn a awful long time ago, and that would have helped.
But I mean, I do want to get back to the, you know, awful metaphor of Swiss cheese. But I do think people in the past have had sloppy peer review. People in the past have made hypotheses that were based on not very good science. People in the past have failed to declare a conflict of interest. But then the media picked it up and carried it. And you know, I think all of us have to accept some blame. I think, you know, you guys as journalists have to accept some blame. We in the health service, for our inability to redress the issue, once the evidence is out there and clear, we were unable to say, actually, guys, be reassured, trust us. We couldn't do that. So all of it failed at every stage. And he had this big emotive body of people supporting him all the way, with money as well as emotionally.
Ian, this is Ben Goldacre's favourite subject. His book was basically, you know, one of the chapters in his book was essentially all about MMR, and he doesn't blame Andrew Wakefield even slightly about any of this. He thinks it's entirely our fault.
I was too tired of the whole situation to read much about this, I have to say, and it was one of those situations where, yes, the media was at fault, undoubtedly. Wakefield was clearly at fault. I think the Journal was at fault. How on earth they can say that it takes them to read the GMC ruling on this before deciding to withdraw that paper, I think is quite shocking, unless you really want to just think, well, actually there is merit in having it in our archive so that it's there for people to reference. And I think maybe that is a decent argument. Maybe it should
but
stand.
What about the argument that scientific research doesn't necessarily, if it's interesting, it just should be out there for people to argue with, and if it's proved to be false, then that's what happens to most scientific research. It just it's left in the background. This is the course of the stuff. So the Lancet might argue, well, it was kind of radical at the time. We don't know if it's true or not, but we should have the debate, be open about it.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I think is that, sadly, I'm not very optimistic that anyone has put their house in order after this event. I mean, Ben has done, you know, an enormous number of pieces and talks about MMR and how badly the media behaved throughout it. It's undoubtedly true, but I think this could easily happen again. I don't think, you know, if there is another scare, and maybe hopefully the specialist will spot things if things look desperately flaky, but it probably will end up being kicked up to sort of, you know, political reporters and stuff like that, and people will run with it again. I'm sure that will happen.
I mean, all the conditions required for this to occur again are definitely still there. And I mean, what I always think when I look at this is how bad we are as a health service at communicating these sorts of issues. You know, what you do in a hospital as an A&E doctor or an intensive care doctor or whatever is just brush fires. You know, the real war is won by public health. And if they can't communicate with the weight of evidence behind them and successive reviews and hard evidence saying this is safe, they can't convince the public that something's safe, then, you know, it's all for nothing. All the hospitals are for nothing.
We'll leave that there. You might be wondering why we're not talking on this podcast about the ClimateGate emails and troubles with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. There have been stories about this all week on The Guardian and The Observer websites, and there's a special podcast of it all with environment correspondents Suzanne Goldenberg, David Adam and James Randerson. Go to guardian.co.uk/guardiandaily for that. In fact, you'll also find it on our Science Weekly podcast feed. So that's it for this week. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, that's @ScienceWeekly, we'll let you know when a new podcast is launched every Monday morning, in case you don't know. And to be alerted to all The Guardian science content, follow @GuardianScience. Thanks to Robin McKee, Ian Sample and Kevin Fong. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Well, Greedo was just a victim, I think.
Greedo wasn't a victim. He was forced by Jabba the Hutt to...
He was a pawn.
He was a pawn. He was a victim. He was a contractor, again, another poor contractor.
Han Solo is pushed back into the cantina by Greedo and goes, Udug Uda Solo, or something like that. He goes, Udug Uda Solo, or something like that. He sits him down and he's like, there's a bounty on your head. And in the original, Han Solo shoots him under the table first. But in the remastered version, Greedo... Sorry, Andy. What you need is Jabba the Hutt in 3D. And it's not Jabba the Hutt. What's his name? That weird one from the first one.
No, they had flat faces, those ones.
No.
That would be rubbish in 3D.
What are they called?
You barely need 2D for them.
The guy who sort of with the ears.
What are you talking about?